thank you for coming this evening. So, I'm going to talk about what I call boundless practice. At least, if you want a title for the talk, it'd be boundless practice. And this is based on some, thinking that I've been doing recently about different parts of our practice. And so, thought I would share that and start with a reading from. What's called the Sutra of Wei Nong. It's really like the collected teachings of Wei Nong, who was the sixth patriarch, and perhaps among the various people credited with being the founders of Zen, I would say in number one place as being a founder of Zen, and was said to be illiterate and heard the Diamond Sutra and had an awakening, but it was a very novice monk, so worked in the kitchen, and they had he was the person who really had a contest to see who would be the next master of the monastery. And one of the senior monks wrote on the wall, something I'll paraphrase, the mind is a mirror, you must practice to, remove the dust from the mirror. And Wei Nong saw this and, had graffiti in the middle of the night, supposedly, and wrote, originally, there is nothing, there is no mirror, how could any dust accumulate? And the master saw this. It's like, ah, that's the guy. But the monks all got mad and he had to flee and go into hiding for a long time. So I guess they were still looking for the dust. But anyway, here's the reading. Here it says, the lands of all Buddhas are all the same as space. The subtle nature of people in the world is originally empty, with nothing that can be grasped. The true emptiness of our inherent nature is also like this. Good friends, don't cling to emptiness when you hear me speak of emptiness. Above all, do not stick to emptiness. If you sit quietly with an empty mind, you are fixated on indifferent voidness. The emptiness of physical space contains the colors and forms of myriad things: sun, moon, stars, mountains, rivers, land, springs, valley streams, grasses, trees, forests, bad people, good people, bad things and good things, heaven and hell, the oceans and the mountains, all are within space. The emptiness of people in the world is also like this. Our inherent nature contains all things. This is greatness. All things are in your essential nature. You see everyone's good and bad, but do not grasp or reject any of it, and do not become affected by it. Your mind is like space. This is called greatness. Good friends, deluded people expound verbally, like I'm doing. Wise people practice mentally, hopefully you're doing. There are also deluded people who sit quietly with empty minds, not thinking of anything whatsoever, and claim this is greatness. This sort of person is not worth talking to because theirs is a wrong view. Good friends, the extent of mind is so vast it pervades the cosmos. When it is used so that it functions adaptively with comprehensive clarity, it knows everything. Everything is one, the one is everything. Coming and going freely, the substance of mind without blockage, this is wisdom. Thank you, Hui Nong. Okay, so this emptiness, right? So there's emptiness, do not cling to emptiness, you're empty, but don't sit there emptily. So there's all this sort of thing which, confession as a Zen student, the term emptiness kind of bothers me. It's so loaded, I think, in our language, in our history of like, with lack, zero, some void, and I have to be a black hole, or I think there's all this kind of cultural overloadedness of emptiness with us. So that's kind of what I was thinking about. So okay, so here's the story. In my job, one of the things that I do is get feedback from people about what they think about technology devices. And some years ago, this was pre-smartphone era, as will become evident in in the course of the story, I had a device. Doesn't matter what it is, but it was a consumer technology device that we were wondering whether should be made as a product. And it gone around doing research in this in various places, and I was in China with a colleague. Neither one of us spoke Chinese or anything, but there were two of us, and I was the organizer of this trip to get feedback from some consumers in China. And so we had arranged a research company there and recruited people to come in and talk in focus groups and whatever, which if you're ever asked to do that, please do it. It makes my job easier. But also, most products, they only talk to like 100 people ever at most before they make them. And so you're representing like millions of people just for you. So please do that. Anyway, we were in China. Had been way out on the western side of Beijing to talk with some colleagues and, in our office there before I went over to the research place. And we had the address of the research place all printed out and stuff, how to get there. And our colleagues like, oh, where are you going? Oh, okay. They went down to the taxi with us and just talking to the taxi driver in Chinese and pointing, and they went back and forth about the address and where we're going. And the part I understood was building, I believe it was 372, building 372. Got in the taxi, and we got to 372, sitting on the side of the building. And we had number 210, so okay, we went up to the second floor and opened the door and went in. It was the middle of a bank, of an accounting office of a bank. There were all these people, like with all these papers on their desks and all these things, and it said, such and such bank, mostly in Chinese. And so we left, went down to the lobby, saw the receptionist in the lobby and kind of pointed to this, and they wrote something out, went out and got another taxi, took the taxi over, and the taxi driver was pointing, we're like, don't think this is it, he's like, it was an empty field. So we were empty. So, like, okay, well, this is not it. So I pulled out a map and was looking. We were way far from anything we knew at this point. But I found, on the map, what looked like the nearest Western hotel, had some name, like, I don't know, I forget the name, Mark's Hotel or something. So I pointed the taxi driver to take us there and went to the Western Hotel, and I figured, well, I can ask their concierge, to help us out, even though it was 20 miles probably from our hotel. So we had the device with us that we were going to test in a little bag, and I should mention there were only 9 of these devices of that in the whole world. They were handmade. They cost over $50,000, each to make them, but we brought one along to test it. So anyway. Get to the hotel and go and talk to the concierge and wrote something down and gave us these things. And we went out to get another taxi to take us there. And I didn't have the device anymore. It was gone. The whole thing we brought to test was gone. And my colleague didn't have it. I didn't have it. So vast emptiness. So and I'm like, okay. So now what? We had no idea. We'd taken, all this stuff at this point. It didn't have a taxi receipt or anything. We paid in cash. Went in and told the concierge, we lost this device. I don't know if you hear anything about it randomly. Here's my business card. I'm staying at the Hyatt Hotel. And gave him a tip. So went out and got the taxi to the next place. And I'm going to pause there before I'll finish the story later. So headed out to the next place. But at this point, device is gone. We're in the middle of Beijing. We don't really know where, except for at this random hotel I pointed to on a map. And trying to get to our research session. So boundless practice brings up the question of how are we bound? Right? So I think if we hear, that somehow our practice is great spaciousness or great openness or great unboundedness or any of these terms, it poses a question that, you know, most of the time we don't feel that way, right? So we're bound by, you know, our history, by our health, by economics, right? By our minds and the things we worry about, you know, by culture. Our language binds us. So we have all these, just like layer after layer of these constraints on us. And, you know, we're taught in our practice that, you know, that, well, this is, you know, all of this is created by mind. And so somehow we can, you know, let go of all these things and achieve mind to be free of those bounds. But that poses the question of how do you do that, right? Because it doesn't feel that way a lot of the time. So, you know, so how do we do that? The one thing that I would suggest to think about is in the Heart Sutra, we're told that, you know, form is emptiness and emptiness is form. But a slightly different translation that I like sometimes is form is boundlessness and boundlessness is form. So the things that seem like they have form and seem like they're bounded, in fact, are unbounded. And the things that may seem unbounded, in fact, can be the same as form. So this, so rather than it being empty, these things that appear to have form are in fact infinite. They're not empty, they're infinite. And it's this unboundedness that we can tap into. Then the question is, well, how do you do that? Okay, so there's this unboundedness of all these things. Maybe we can buy that, some Mahayana philosophy here. But exactly what do you do for this unboundedness? And I think we have another guide that we have in our practice. You know, every single practice, which is the Four Great Vows as a guide. And the Four Great Vows, they tell us, you know, sentient beings are numberless, they're unbounded. Sentient beings are numberless. We vow to save them all. Delusions are unbounded. We vow to cut through them all. Teachings are infinite, so they're unbounded. We're going to learn them all. And the Buddha way is unbounded, but, you know, we're going to attain it. But I think one of the things that helps with that is that there's a problem, at least that I sometimes perceive with the Great Vows, that we're going to save them all. So I'm going to do something, I'm going to save all of them all at once. And it's a failure if I'm not saving all of them all at once. Now there's philosophical kind of reasoning behind this, you know, thing that the Buddha says, you know, now I attain enlightenment and all beings are enlightened at the same time. So there's this linkage between the one and the absolute. But what I would prefer from a practice point of view of working on this is to think of the vows as not them all, but each one. So sentient beings are numberless. I will save each one, just one at a time. This one that's right here. This one that's right here. And it's just one. What is all? All is a collection of these ones. And that's all we can do is who's in front of us, save them. Which delusion is coming and attacking us on the cushion? You know, try to cut through that one. And if you cut through that one at that moment, that is all. But it's a much more achievable, I think, sort of vow to take the things one at a time. And we know that. I mean, we all do that in our practice. Everyone here has, you know, one of these and knows this. But I think bringing it back into really, you know, kind of letting go of the cosmic vision and coming back to this, you know, step-by-step vision is at least one of the practices I'm trying. So then we have something like the Heart Sutras. Form is boundlessness. Boundlessness is form. And our vows become, you know, sentient beings are numberless. Work to save each one, one by one. So then this question, well, how do you do that? Right, each one, one at a time. And I think one thing, and this is where the talk about saving them all is perhaps, daunting and a bit leading us away in a certain way, even if it's, true in another way. I think the way to do one of them is to bring them closer. Bring them closer, whatever it is, to engage. I heard this week in the news, there was a social science study that some folks from Stanford, University of Chicago, and so forth, that you may have heard of it, called America in One Room. And so the idea of America in One Room was they went and recruited, I think it was 500 and some odd people, who were, quote, scientifically selected, to represent all of America. So they had these people with all these different backgrounds and points of view and languages and histories and political views and demographics and parts of the country and all this. So they selected this sample of 500 people who are as diverse as everyone in America. And they got them together for a series of workshops to talk about what should the country do. So they had briefing books and this and that, and they studied and had this talks and whatever. But one of the things they found was that at the beginning they were highly polarized. Only 30% of the people thought our country was in good shape, our government. These people were like, whatever their political view was, they were super fixated on it. And they found at the end of these several days that they were together and talking in these small groups, that their views shifted dramatically. 60% of them now thought the country was in pretty good shape after getting to meet all these other people who were different than them. And their attachment to whatever it was, ban all the immigrants or, give out basic income or whatever it was on either side of the political, all kind of came more together and more towards the middle. So a lot more agreement just from getting closer. And so instead of being attached to, the big thing and, fighting for it, just talking and coming together. Dramatic change. So what happened with my device in China? So we were in this taxi now without the device. We're like, well, can't do our research anymore, but I guess we'll go to the research place and talk to the people, something like that. So we had our new map, the concierge had written for us, new taxi, the taxi out. He's like, yeah, this building's 372 on it. It was like a 3 or 4 story building. Like, okay, doesn't look like where I'd put a research agency, but fine, it's in an office park. And stuff is okay. So we went to this building and went up to the second floor and saw, number 210. Number 210. Opened the door, walked in. We're in the middle of an acupuncture school. They were late. I was like, in the classroom, they slide. So I kid you not. Really. They didn't speak any English. They got on the phone and got very excited and talked to some people. And then we finally left. Our taxi was gone. There were no other taxis around. We're in this office park, and we're like, okay. So we started walking back toward the main road, and I see off in the distance another building 372. It said 372 on the side. I'm like, how many 372s can there be in Beijing? So we're like, okay. So we walked to that place and we went into the lobby and there was no number 210 or anything else. But I was looking at the list of the companies, and the company we were Consolidated Research was not on the wall. And we're like, well, gosh. So I was looking, I finally saw, we'll call them Acme. I saw Acme on the wall. I'm like, you know, I think Acme is a research place too. So let's just, we have nothing else to do. It was after our time to meet the people anyway, so by this point. So we're like, we went up to Acme. And they're like, you're here! Oh my God, we've been waiting on you. We started with, you know, stuff. So sure enough, after these multiple redirects and all this stuff, just seeing the building and going there, we finally got to the place without the device. But we were able at least to talk to our customers. So it was one of the more hair-raising days that I've ever had at work at this point. And I'm like, yeah, I don't, you know, they're not going to make me pay for the device, but they're going to be happy about it. Anyway, so we talked to the people. I went back to my hotel room that night and quite exhausted. And I went to my hotel room, turned on the lights. In the middle of my desk was the device. It was sitting there on my desk. So I don't know how, must have been the taxi driver found it at some point, associated with us, remembered where he'd picked us up, took it back to that hotel I'd given my business card to, who remembered where I was staying and sent it over and whatever, but the device came back. So all this just, you know, this being totally lost and at the mercy of, you know, it was Beijing, 20,000 people or something, or 20 million people. And it's kind of lost, but, you know, all we did was just keep going with, you know, because what else could we do? And it found its way back. You know, why? Probably because, you know, everybody else we crossed paths with was paying more attention than we were. And they took care of us, even though we had no way to know we were expected at the time. And so that, you know, incredible kind of this connectedness of all the people there, you know, worked out. Some closing. What do I think we do? Right. Sentient beings are numberless. Save each one, just one by one. Delusions are endless. Cut through each one. The teachings are infinite. All we can do is learn one at a time. The Buddha way is inconceivable. But we just attain it one step at a time. And each one of those one things is infinite in itself. And we know all of that. But just paying that attention to one thing after one thing after one thing, I think that's our boundless practice. So, thank you for coming.
Thank you, Chris. Yeah. Thank you for your boundless talk.
Thank you. How unbounded was it? Not too bad. So,
so just any questions? Yes.
What was the device?
The device, which I can say now, because we ended up publishing something. It wasn't made, but it was published. And now you can get a similar device, although it took a long time. Was called SenseCam. It was a wearable camera, and the idea is you wear it somewhere on your body, and it takes pictures everywhere you go automatically. And then at the end of the day, or the end of a party, or an event, or something. You have a digital memory of that event, but that you can view, and unlike a video film, you could view it in kind of speed it up. So you can see like a whole day in 3 minutes. It's quite a kind of a fascinating concept. There were some made to use for memory loss purposes and some things, and now they're consumer products that effectively are similar. Yeah, it felt that way. Well, you know, the thing about what happened to us in Beijing is nothing unusual. I mean, it's a little bit dramatic because, you know, we were lost in this place, but honestly, I think, you know, every one of us has something like that every week where things just go totally awry. So, yeah, so that part's just, you know, the same.
In a world that's constantly awry.
Yes.
The question for any of you is the cosmic and the practical, are they the same or different? Only that?
It's wonderful to see you this evening.
Are you sure?
Well, we'll find out. So.
Yeah. So just to add a little addendum to this talk, you know, a couple of things. I really appreciate your digging in to what words signify or what they trigger in us. However, they are all faulty. And that, I think, needs to be said. That they are all short of the mark. That's really important. In the meticulousness of Zen, that is why we do things like actually that, or cut, or, you know, there are arguments that could be made for any number of words. And all of them are lovely. All of them are awful. you know, you ask this most important question, which is, how do we do it? How do we attain it? Because we could talk around emptiness, we could talk our way around inside and out of boundlessness, or various things. Human beings are really good at that. People who deal with words like yours truly can get lost. Quite a lengthy process of refinement of language. But you know, the critical thing to do, as you suggest in your talk, is this moment by moment, what is this? Just do it. We have a kind of sparseness in our Zen vocabulary. And, you know, it occurs to me that whether you land on boundlessness or before thinking mind, don't know mind, what was it, the one that you brought up not too long ago from Jibong Sansa? Nothing separate. Spacious awareness. You could tally off a long list of words. Pick the one you like, I don't care. But there's the job to be done. There's the work to be done. And you know that we have to say something, and we have to look at language. So, you know, I appreciate the examination. At this point, I don't feel like we need to pick any. And even those thorny ones, like in the four great vows. You know, at one point, I remember we went to Jibong Sansa and said, let's change them. He said, over my dead body. Something like that. And I appreciated his putting the brakes on this, because I think that, and I was talking to a long conversation with a Zen student by email recently about change, in as you know, the language comes to us from the East, and gets sort of roughly translated. And of course, it's had a long migration all the way back from its origins. And, you know, what was I going to say about that? Well, it's just about changing the language. Here in the US, because of all of our devices and our access to information, you could find any language you like. And it won't help you, just to be blunt. And you know that in some ways, you know, it's what kind of platform do you have that can attract people? I was talking with Lisa, also by email, about this aspect of change and language, and she was talking about Adyashanti. How many of you know about the teacher that's kind of popular online? Adya, he's known as. And one of his kind of marketing principles, I'm sort of giving away some of my opinion by saying that, is that I don't rely on any dogma, any religious creed, no Buddhism, no anything. And so then he tells what his shtick is, and what is it? It's the same. It's the same. It's absolutely the same. He's just dressing it up in different language, and putting a big I in front of it. My teaching stands alone. So, you know, what do we do? The important question: what do we do? You know, we do this work, as Chris was saying, moment by moment. Wake up. Wake up. There's a great urgency. You could use Christ consciousness. You could use, whatever religious orientation you came out of. It's okay. If you understand that the core experience is before thinking mind, boundlessness, etc., 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 emptiness, everything. I think I better get off my hobby horse. any questions, commentary on that? Yes?
I'd like to make a comment.
Please.
Boundless, to me, in my mind, free association, free. Freedom, and why that's particularly in my mind is I just got back from Washington, D.C., and I had an opportunity to tour American history as well as African American history, and the concept of freedom and being free and not being bound, and how that was expressed in the words of a number of African through their experience since like the 1400s. And I remember one thing that was written on one of the walls that was particularly, that stuck with me, was a person who said that she would rather be free, even if she knew she could only be free for a minute, and then she'd be killed afterwards, she'd die, than to continue living the way she was living, as a bound. Belonging to someone, this, you know, being. And in my image, I have like the manacles and the chains, you know, being bound, being held back, you know, from being who you want to be. And that it brings it, you know, that's what's reflecting, resonating with me, this concept of not being bound, of being free, of breaking the chain.
You know, that reminds me of in the temple rules where it says, break through the wall of self, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That is a very powerful quote that you just offered. 1 minute. And again, it comes to, in our practice, 1 minute, one moment, one situation.
Interesting. I've never had a problem with the term emptiness in reference to Zen. I mean, I know it has other connotations outside of Zen, but in the Zen context. But then when you mentioned boundlessness as sort of synonymous within the context of Zen, I thought, oh, that's right. This emptiness feeling that I have when I'm meditating is boundless. I just never, you know, I conceptual. I didn't I didn't assign those words to it, or the word boundless, but it really, I mean, so I appreciated you, you know, saying, here's another term.
Well, thank you. Yeah, and I hope it was clear, but, you know, I didn't intend to recommend it as like, oh, emptiness should be, you know, replaced with this, you know, and go through and edit everything, but rather that it's, you know, we can expand our view, and if the language helps us to expand that, then wonderful.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I was thinking in addition, it's wonderful to have things that I've sort of come to understand. And this is the word for that, but I don't quite know why, because I hadn't really thought about it in words. You know, I just know that emptiness is associated with this experience that I have, and then you brought up boundless, and I was like, boundlessness, oh, right, I've heard that too. I just didn't know that the two were connected, but of course they are.
Yeah, Claire's reflection, thank you for that, also reminds me of the, you know, how incredibly fortunate all of us are to be able to have this practice. I mean, some, you know, in theory, right, everything's created by mind alone, and everyone, you know, hypothetically should be able to practice or whatever. But the fact is, many of, you know, the literal chains and binds that people have make practice impossible for so many of them. And how fortunate we are that we can practice for the world, you know, and try to help, you know, help the many people who can't.
I say I really appreciated that poignant passage that you read too. We've been doing the book club reading Thich Nhat and I was coming to think of that, you know, this was sort of themes that he had really developed, but that was so clear. He was amplifying that, and that's probably from further back than that. So that's all.
Yeah, that was a really good quote. Yeah, I mean, certainly it reflects back on the Buddha's awakening experience, where, you know, he hesitates, and there's this impulse to just stay in that space. Then he gets up, gets to work.
I'm wondering, could we read it again? I kind of feel like I...
The Kuai Nang? Oh. You know, I thought about it, actually, I didn't read the one version I wrote down, read it again at the end. thank you for asking. Yes, it says, the lands of all Buddhas are the same as space. The subtle nature of people in the world is originally empty, with nothing that can be grasped. The true emptiness of our inherent nature is also like this. Good friends, don't cling to emptiness when you hear me speak of emptiness. Above all, do not stick to emptiness. If you sit quietly with an empty mind, you are fixated on indifferent voidness. The emptiness of physical space contains the colors and forms of myriad things: the sun, moon, stars, mountains, rivers, land, springs, valley streams, grasses, trees, forests, bad people and good people, bad things and good things, heaven and hell, oceans and the mountains, all are within space. The emptiness of the essential nature of people in the world is also like this. Our inherent nature contains all things. This is greatness. All things are in your essential nature. If you see everyone's good and bad, but do not grasp or reject any of it, and do not become affected by it, your mind is like space. This is called greatness. Good friends, deluded people expound verbally. Wise people practice mentally. There are also deluded people who sit quietly with empty minds, not thinking of anything whatsoever, and claim this is greatness. This sort of person is not worth talking to. because theirs is the wrong view. The extent of mind is so vast it pervades the cosmos. When it is used so that it functions adaptively with comprehensive clarity, it knows everything. Everything is one. The one is everything. Going and coming freely, the substance of mind without blockage, this is wisdom.
We have a koan that sums that up in one sentence. 10,000 dharmas return to the one. Where does the one return to?
Can you say that again?
The 10,000 dharmas return to the one. Where does the one return to? So then in shorthand Zen language, 10,000 means all the phenomenal stuff. Yeah, all the stuff. All the relative stuff. Coming and going. That city in Beijing. 10,000 things. I'll bet we could. Huh?
All those buildings with 370. There
are 10,000 of them.
I think the two of us could trade Beijing stories all night long, and they'd all be like that. Something about that city. I think that, you know, in terms of the practicality of how we practice with language, you know that when we teach new people how to do meditation, one of the first methods of focusing we use is to watch or follow the breath, and as you're inhaling, inhale, clear mind, clear mind, clear mind, exhale, one lung, don't know. One thing that I like to offer people is that as Sage was suggesting, and certainly you, there are certain words that kind of crack things open for us, mm-hmm. and no one can know that better than you. So, you know, that, for example, in my own case, sometimes when my mind's particularly wild, I'll go back to this clear mind, clear mind, clear mind. But instead of saying, clear mind, clear mind, clear mind. What does it for me is clear like space. Why? I don't know. But it cracks things open for me more than repeating clear mind, clear mind. So I think that we need to, as trusting our own understanding, our own mind, we can use that format. Really, also use who we are as individuals. I mean, Sung San was famous for saying you could just chant Coca-Cola if you really believe it. But of course, that's. I will just stick my neck out and say, don't. Because I don't think it's taking you the right direction. But he's making a good point, and it's essentially the same point. Know who you are, trust that, and work with it.